Accession number 28678, Miss Dermot Rhodes, Reel 10. Now, what happened after the Barra patrols, or is anything else on that period?
I think the final event in the Barra patrol was taking part in a beard growing competition on board. One of the many things we did to sort of make life a little more interesting. Unfortunately, my beard turned out to be ginger when I got sort of blondish hair, so I kept it on till I got home, but it didn't stay on much longer after that. And after the Barra patrol,
what were the rules of the competition? I mean, presumably you all started clean shaven.
Well, the rules were to start clean shaven, but I mean, there were normal naval beard growing competitions. You had to have the commanding officer's permission not to grow a beard in the Navy. It was an official request to stop shaving, because the captain could grant permission for you to stop shaving. He could not order you to grow a beard, because you'd be incapable, as some people were, of growing a beard. So we stopped shaving, and I think 3 weeks afterwards we had another sort of get-together of those who'd entered the competition to judge. And you were not allowed to cut, trim, shave, or anything the beards, as indeed those are the rules for normal hirsute, chinned personnel. You can trim them, of course, when they're of a suitable size for trimming. So that was the beard growing competition whilst we were on Byra.
So for you it was a bit of a disaster.
Well, no, I grew a decent beard. It was just a weird colour compared with my hair on my head. But it was good fun.
Anything else? What next?
We then set off home, and our first port of call after that was Mombasa, to have a bit of a break from the... We'd done 5 weeks, I think, on the Barra patrol, which is a long time to be at sea continuously. And although we kept ourselves fairly busy and happy, it was time we had a good run ashore. And so we went to Mombasa, which was great. We were actually moored in the harbour. We weren't able to get alongside.
Is that Kenya?
It's Kenya, yes. It's Kenya. And we had extremely good hospitality from ashore. We were made members of the Mombasa Club, which had a lovely swimming pool. By an extraordinary good stroke of good fortune, there was a wonderful bar and an even better beach just up the coast, and the name of this establishment was the Tata Frigate, and we were HMS Tata Frigate, and so we spent quite a lot of time there, enjoyed it. We played a lot of usual sports, hockey, cricket, cocktail parties on board, investigating the strange wooden carvings that you see in all African ports. And we spent about a week there, and then set off south, back South Africa on the way, Cape Town, which was a bit of a sort of fueling stop and replenishing, victualling stores, pick up mail. Yet again, extremely hospitable. A lot of ex-naval personnel, Royal Naval personnel, in South Africa, that, well, I suppose there still are, and they made us feel very welcome. Apartheid was still, sadly, very much in evidence, so we had to be careful to abide by the rules, but it was obviously a country that was not terribly happy politically. But absolutely wonderful beaches and stupendous scenery, and a place not to be missed. And we did our sort of farewell shopping there, then came back up the Southern Atlantic to Gibraltar. And I'm trying to think, I don't think we stopped anywhere. We might have stopped at Sierra Leone for fueling, but it was only a matter of hours. We certainly didn't stop for any length of time. To Gibraltar, where we had a much longer stay. Gibraltar is always the favourite port of call for ships coming back from the Far East, the Middle East, Mediterranean. And it's a place where you can always get presents if you've forgotten to get any on the previous sort of months and even years that you've been away. And it's
why was it so popular? Just because of the present?
Well, it had a wealth of shops that sold duty-free perfumes, cameras, all sorts of luxury goods. Almost anything you would want to get, you could get there. It was also a bit like home. The policemen wore English uniforms, and everybody spoke English there. The place was full of pubs, which sold beer on tap. And it was an English colony. And there was a naval hospital staffed with naval nurses and RN doctors. There was a school there, also headmaster. There was a naval commander. There was a large detachment of the Royal Air Force there, and an army regiment as well. So it was very much service orientated, and in those days we still had full use of the extensive dockyard facilities, and there was an Admiral flag, also Gibraltar flew his flag there. And so we spent a few days there and then came home. By which time I was a lieutenant commander.
Now, what difference did it make to being promoted to lieutenant commander?
Well, to get to a lieutenant, you always had to pass exams or gain qualifications of some kind, whether it was a watchkeeping ticket or pass all your courses and all your other exams. But to make rank of lieutenant commander, you had to do just 8 years seniority as a lieutenant. This is on the long career, the generalist, as they used to call it. So, and after 8 years, you were automatically promoted.
Now, did it make much of a difference in the sort of jobs you got or role?
Yes, it did. But there were jobs where you could be promoted in the job and still stay in that rank. It didn't make as much a difference as later promotions did, by any manner of means. But as a lieutenant commander, you were really in a different league, because you were then regarded as a very seasoned and experienced officer, both as a specialist and, in my case, as a seaman officer. And as a lieutenant commander, you were then ripe for a whole raft of promotions, of jobs, like first lieutenants of frigates, even commanding officers, small frigates, commanding officers of minesweepers, although some lieutenants did that as well. Senior staff jobs in the shore establishments and the specialist schools. And of course there were lieutenant commanders who never got any further than that.
Now what... when did you get back? Was that the end of the commission of the ship, or did you stay with her?
No, it was the end of the ship. I joined the Tartar in December 66, and I left in the beginning of 1969. Let's say it must have been April or May I left her.
Now, were you sorry to leave her?
I was very sorry. I've always been sorry to leave all my ships. I've been very lucky. Made some wonderful friends there and served with some very good ship's companies. I had two excellent captains. And again, we had quite a varied sort of commission in seeing a part of the world I'd never been to before, which was the Middle East.
And the whole ship's crew of it, the end of the ship's commission...
No, they didn't. They kept changing the rules, and by then they were operating a routine called trickle drafting. Instead of drafting the whole ship's company en masse out and then refitting it and bringing another lot in, by then they'd decided that this wasn't very sort of cost-effective insofar as you had to start completely from scratch with brand new people. And so they rotated them by a third each time over a period of about a year. So you got some form of continuity.
So a third went?
Yes.
Now, what happened to you in April of 69?
Well, I went home for some leave, and I was then appointed to HMS Excellent, the Gunnery School, on the staff there as a senior staff officer. And I was staff officer policy, which is a lieutenant commander's job.
And what exactly did that entail?
A large portion of it entailed instructing commanding officers designate of all types of ships on the gunnery systems and the missile systems they had in their ships, and also doing quite a comprehensive threat, which was then mainly Soviet, threat series of lectures for them. That was one of the main jobs I had. I was also involved very much in being the gunnery and missile school's representative for command team training, the action speed teacher tactical training, which was carried out at HMS Dryad. And this is where ships companies would go for, I think it was a 2-week period. They had a series of cubicles in this trainer which replicated the operations rooms of various classes of ships. And you normally went into the class of ship you were going to with your team, right from the commanding officer down to able seaman. And they were then trained and brought up in increasingly advanced tactical exercises, anti-submarine, anti-air navigation sometimes, but it's mainly anti-submarine, the air warfare side, and concentrating on communications. And they also did quite a lot of on the amphibious side as well.
And this is at HMS, where is HMS
Dryad? HMS Dryad was near Portsmouth, Southwark Park, which is where General Eisenhower planned D-Day from.
And how did these exercises go, would you say? How realistic, how good were they?
Well, they were as realistic as you can ever make an exercise, a seagoing exercise and on shore. The simulators were quite realistic, and they were manned by a very expert and well-practiced team of quite often mainly Wrens, who acted as the control and also outstations in the other ships. And you get whole fleets being driven around and squadrons against a certain amount of attack, whether it's incoming submarines or other ships or aircraft or whatever. And the games normally lasted half a day, and there you had a briefing beforehand, play the game and then wash up afterwards. And I then took my role during these games as the senior gunnery and missile representative, and was part of the control team, and gave a debrief afterwards to tell them how good they were or how not, as the case may be. And of course, every ship was different. But it was interesting, fascinating. I thoroughly enjoyed that aspect of my job.
What else were you doing?
Well, I was also, my appointment in that job was also as flotilla gunnery officer to flag officer submarines.
Now, what did that entail?
Now, not long before I took over the job, I'm talking about a few years, every submarine had a gun. You know, quite a substantially sized medium-range gun, 4-inch or something, on the casing. You know, we'll see it in U-boats during the war, submarine actions, gun actions. And the gunnery training and action was supervised by the gunnery school. Now, it was a bit of a sort of sinecure when I went, because there weren't too many guns left in submarines. But they were very keen. The submarine school was still very keen to keep their flotilla gunnery officer, because they thought he sounded rather grand. But he didn't actually have very much to do. So I used to go over to Fort Blockhouse, HMS Dolphin, which is a submarine base in Portsmouth, about once every couple of weeks, to see if there are any submarines around with any queries or problems in their gun drill side. And occasionally to go to sea and watch them do the gun drill. But that was a decreasing job, and I think it disappeared a couple of years after I left.
Anything else?
I was also responsible for overseeing tactics and writing future policy for the use of guns and dealing with the various ministerial departments in the Ministry of Defence with regard to weapons and future projects, particularly people like, well, it's the old ones, DNW, which is the Director of Naval Warfare, DNOR, which is the Director of Naval's Operational Research.
Now, were there any great controversies burning at the time in the question of gunnery tactics and new weapons?
Oh, yes, there were. I mean, there was a tremendous controversy when, led by Admiral Sir Edward Ashmore, thought, and I'm not quite sure what job he had at the time, but the Ministry of Defence said that they thought the training of specialist officers in specialisations, gunnery, torpedo, navigation, communications, it was a waste of time, and all ought to be trained to do everything. And so the PWO concept was born, the Principal Warfare Officer concept was born, which we call Jack of All Trades and Master of None. And the schools, as you might expect, were not very happy about this, because certainly they could see their influence disappearing, but they thought that just one man just could not perform all those responsibilities with regard to the specialisations that used to be done by a specialist officer on board. And their idea was that one man should be able to fight the ops room in watches, and therefore the principal warfare officer would be able to conduct anti-submarine actions and anti-air and anti-surface, and have an overall knowledge of electronic warfare communications. Now, in fact, the system already allowed for that, because when the gunnery officer was in charge in the ops room, there was no, he could certainly start an anti-submarine action, but you whistled up the specialist or the expert out of his bunk if you got sort of bounced, and he wasn't around. So this went to and fro for some time, and I remember spending quite a lot of time with my senior staff colleagues, closeted with the captain of Excellent and the commander, the gunnery commander. But like a lot of ideas that came down from the Ministry of Defence, the die was cast before we were invited to make our comments, purely as a matter of, courtesy, or just to say they had consulted the schools. And so it was brought in, the Principal Warfare Officer concept. And they stopped specialist courses, not while I was there, but a bit later. However, it was not long, a year or two, before they started bringing back in the specialist. And so instead of, but they wouldn't call them gunnery officers and torpedo officers, anti-submarine officers, they call them above water warfare specialists and below underwater warfare specialists. Navigators became specialists again, so did communicators. However, that's a long way down the trail. And I left HMS Excellent, there was a staff officer there in 1970.
When about? You'd gone there, what, April, or would it be May after you leave?
May.
When did you leave?
And I left in late 1970. The autumn of 1970.
Now, anything else happened while you were there, or was that it, pretty well?
That was about it, I think.
Okay.
Kept me going, I played a lot of sport.
What's your next posting?
Then I was appointed first lieutenant of HMS Bacchante, which was a Batch 3 Leander class frigate, brand new one almost. It had, I was about to relieve the first lieutenant building.
Now that's an interesting, an important posting, the first lieutenant, I suppose.
Well, I thought it was, but it was one I'd always wanted. And I was heartened by when I remember seeing the Flag Officer Second Flotilla. I can't remember his name now.
Is it? Were you in the Second Flotilla?
We weren't then, but no, I'd met him at HMS Excellent. He came through Excellent, and he asked me what I was doing, and I said, well, I was just about to leave. And he said, he was Flag Officer Flotilla, 7th Fleet. And he said, where are you going? I said, I was going as first to the canteen. And he said, best frigate in the fleet, which is a good a good omen.
Now, where was she? Wasn't in the flotilla, was she, or was?
No, she was then. She was out in the Caribbean. And I had quite an interesting journey out to find her.
Tell us about that, then.
Well, my joining instructions, you always request joining instructions, and normally it's fairly easy with the ship. You join in Portsmouth or Plymouth or Devonport or Singapore or Hong Kong or Malta or whatever. But this, she was somewhere in the Caribbean going around, and I got a sort of a rundown of what she was likely to be in. Way out to the Caribbean. And we, right until the time I left UK, I was sort of trying to find out where the ship was. Anyway, I flew from Heathrow to Miami, and then from I'd been told the ship was in off Puerto Rico, and so I flew from Miami to San Juan, and that was a very interesting trip because the plane was full of sort of, I won't say peasants, but farmers, it seemed. On their way back to San Juan, because there were dogs and all chickens and all sorts of things in this plane, and me, and arrived in San Juan about 7 o'clock in the evening. I tried to get a taxi. My ship, I found, was on the other side of the island, and all the taxi drivers said they weren't going to go over the mountains this time of night. And so I got a bed for the night, and there's a little American naval base there. And then was driven out next day to my ship. Was working with another naval base on the other side of the island, and sat there while they said, "Oh well, yes, the helicopter comes in, you know, from time to time." And so they made contact with the ship. Said I was there waiting, and eventually, after about 3 hours, the ship's Wasp appeared. When I climbed on board. And arrived on the ship eventually.
And this is which island was she at? Sorry, I'm
Puerto Rico.
Now, what were your first impressions and reception on joining the ship?
Well, the chap I was relieving was a well known sort of I won't say a comedian, but he was a larger than life character, quite amusing. And as I stepped out of this helicopter, and I'd been travelling, I don't know, well over 24 hours, he handed me the large daily orders book and said, "Here you are, this is yours, it's all yours now." It disappeared. This was all part of the joke of the reception. That was for me to write the orders for the next day and get on with it. But my first impression was very good. It was an immaculately clean ship, and a very lively and interesting and cheerful bunch of blokes right from top to bottom.
Now, can you tell us a bit about the Bacchante, the nature of the ship? Because as a Leander class,
The Leander class was quite a common class after the war. I think there were about 26 of them in the end.
Frigates.
About 2,500 tons, 3,000 tons, 2,500 tons, I think. Crew of about 250. Main armament was one twin 4.5-inch medium-range gunnery system. They had 40mm Bofors anti-aircraft guns. They had a Wasp helicopter. They had homing torpedoes, which were fired by tubes and dropped from a helicopter, which could also drop depth charges. about it.
Good seagoers?
Yes, they were lovely ships, nice ships, very, very, very comfortable, and you know, they got air conditioning, and we had them. We were the most modern, the last batch they built of those frigates, so we had all the updated equipment.
What was your accommodation like?
My accommodation was almost even as first returned. It was about the same as it was in the other frigate, Tartar, and in Devonshire, standard 6x6, perhaps a few inches bigger, but not very much.
My captain,
which I have to say was a chap called, he was then a commander, Julian Oswald, also a gunnery specialist, but he ended up as Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Julian Oswald, who's Commander in Chief Fleet and First Sea Lord.
And what was he like?
Great. He was a very, he was a quietish man, utterly polite and gentlemanly, and he was very understanding. He was very popular with the sailors because he'd always listen and he'd talk and he'd be interesting and chat, but he wasn't over the top. And he was, of course, superb with that many visitors we had on board, and a very good frigate captain.
How was he with you?
Terrific. I mean, I just can't think of any criticism at all. I used to go to his house, met his wife, lovely wife, and children, and he was extremely kind and considerate to me, but I didn't get away with anything. I mean, I kept the ship ticking for him.
Now, can you just sketch out for us what the duties were as first lieutenant? I mean,
first lieutenant is second in command, is basically it. So if anything happens to the captain, you take command. Now, that can be anything from illness, injury, to the captain having to go leave the ship for anything, duty, conferences, because he's sent for, or whatever. You then automatically take command when he's not on board. And also, as first lieutenant, you were president of the wardroom officers' mess. The captain was not a member of the wardroom mess.
What did that entail?
Well, that means running the wardroom mess and seeing to the welfare and behaviour of all the other officers, actually. Making sure it was run properly.
How did you do that? I mean, it's one thing to say that, you know, you can do something. How did you actually run the mess? Or did you get someone else to do it?
The petty officer steward or chief petty officer steward had a team of stewards who looked after the cleanliness and the layout, and the caterer looked after the catering. So the food and the layout and everything to do with the physical aspects of the mess infrastructure were looked after by specialist cooks and stewards. And the wardroom mess was run by, to some degree, a small committee. But that committee provided, you had a social secretary, a very important chap, the wine caterer, who made sure you had adequate stocks of wine and the right wine and ran all the accounts. Another chap did minerals. Or soft drinks and so on and so forth, and they ran the committee for the commander. They ran these aspects for the commander, and he chaired the wardroom mess committee, and as president of the wardroom mess was responsible for everything overall. He wrote the orders for the conduct of the not only the ship, but also the officers and the wardroom, bar hours, when the mess was open, dress in the mess, conduct, visitors, who was allowed, when, and so on and so forth. So it was the domestic things, like being the head of a house in ashore.